This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham.
What does it feel like to save a life? To rescue someone trapped in a burning building? To sit with a fire victim who's just seen their home destroyed and give them hope that life can still be good? This hour's guest can address each of these questions. His new book documents his many years as a Norfolk, Virginia firefighter. Yet, maybe you have a perspective too. Have you ever done any kind of emergency rescue work? Been close to someone who has? Or even been on the receiving side of that kind of help? The new memoir, at the heart of today's discussion, unveils aspects of the firefighter's life most of us have never imagined. So we're sure you'll want to hear what this retired fireman has to say. But your insights will be welcome too. And we talk with Danny Lateris, author of Flames and Smoke Visible, right after the news. Great to be with you. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. We are focused today on one man's life as a rescue worker. But if you have any experiences in that realm of any kind, we want to hear from you as well. 888-WMRA-TALK is how to reach us by phone. In all numbers, that's 888-967-2825. The book is titled Flames and Smoke Visible, A Firefighter's Tale. On the cover, the author is listed as D.S. Lateris, but most everybody just calls him Danny. So, Danny Lateris, welcome to Virginia Insight.
Thanks. Thanks for having me there, Tom. I really appreciate this.
What does it feel like to save a life?
First time question, by the way. Nobody's ever asked me that. And, you know, really, it's, I don't really know half the time. It's an understated pride. I really don't think about it, but I'm thankful of the success. And, you know, really saving a life is a collective process, a team process. You don't ever do it by yourself in the fire companies. Everybody's taken part in that particular save. And if you're actually carrying that person, that's the end product of 4, 5 to 8 guys and gals getting you to that point. So it's kind of like when you get out of that building with that person, it's kind of like we all did it together, and that's really how it operates.
Danny, I know you well enough that I realize any question like this that I ask you, I'm going to get modesty and humility.
Well,
but I'm going to press you on this point, and I think anybody listening will understand why in a little while when we talk about some of your other work where life-saving was a major part of what you were doing on battlefields, for example. My question was, what does it feel like to save a life? Whether you're taking sole credit for it or shifting credit mostly off to anyone else or not, can you describe what you're feeling while you're in the midst of the attempt and what it feels like once you realize the attempt has been successful?
Well, really, when you're in the midst of it, you're not feeling anything. When you're in the midst of it, you're trying to get it done. You're in the practical mode of actually saving that person's life. You are not thinking. You're thinking about the job, the protocol, the procedures, what to do, how to do it, and getting it done.
Is there some kind of rush of adrenaline that you have to fight off that clouds your thinking?
No, the adrenaline's been long there. You had the adrenaline going before you even got to the scene. You're ready to go. I mean, that's part of the job. You're running hard, you're ready to go, and you give yourself this momentary calm just before you reach the scene. I mean, everybody, look, you know, it's a quiet love for the job, and it's this thing that you just don't know where this is going to go, and all time stops. There's no future than the present moment, truly. And when you step out of that piece or jump off that tailboard, you're thinking, okay, what's next? What do I do next? How do I get there? How do I reach that person? What do I do when I get there? As you're doing it, you're not thinking about it. Because after a while, you just know. You just do it. And you don't have emotion. Now, you may get a little sense of fear once in a while when you get into a place that's particularly dangerous. Well, you'd be surprised how much you disregard those kinds of things. And that's what makes firefighters so great. And that's what makes all rescue people so great. They forget themselves for a while, and they're trying to get at trying to save this life. And even when it's over, you know, the come down from it is you're so exhausted, you're so grateful that you're also still alive and they're alive. You almost don't even come to recognize your feelings until you're back in the galley having a cup of coffee, you know, and sitting around with the other guys and gals saying, hey, man, that was a good job.
What's it like then?
What's that?
What's it like then?
Feels pretty good. You know, everybody's kind of, you know, the true firefighters, they like to understate it. You know, you get back to the galley after a scene, and people don't really talk about it except they look at each other and kind of go, good job. They don't really talk about it that much. You know, the irony is when you really talk about a scene is when we've made mistakes. That's when we talk about it on the galley, like, damn, I could have done this better. I should have done that better. And it's sort of like constructive criticism. You know, you say, well, yeah, you know, we should have done this, right? Or we should have done that. It would have made it better. And it's not a bad thing. That's actually a very positive, constructive criticism. Ironically, that's what you talk about. Everybody knows you did a good job when you do. It's that sitting around at the galley, having a quiet cup of coffee, being part of that team, and everybody knowing we all did something great. You did a good job at that. And you'll get an attaboy here and there, and it's quiet. And it's great. It's a great feeling. It's really understated, really very understated.
Danny Lateris, author of this new memoir, Flames and Smoke Visible. Your book begins on the day your life almost ended.
Right, right.
Tell us about that day.
Well, I didn't know that, of course, this was going to happen. And I came to the fire station, and I came in on a night trick. I had the day off, and with a quiet night. And Station 15 is actually a night runner. Each station has its personalities. And Station 15 was known to be an engine that ran all night long. So you try to get a little nap in the daytime because you knew you were going to be up. And that was typical of 15. So the book begins the night the brass hit. Woke me up around 3 in the morning. And the dispatcher announced that I had a 10-1 house fire. And the address was at the Ocean View area of Norfolk. And, you know, as soon as I swung my legs over the side of my bed I stood up, I knew there was something wrong with me. And, you know, I wasn't right. I didn't feel like myself. And, you know, the fact of the matter is I collapsed during the incident. You know, I got on the engine. I felt very heavy. I barely was able to get my turnout gear on. And when we were riding down to the scene, I could barely get my tank on. It felt a lot heavier than it usually did. Everything took greater effort.
But and you kept going.
I kept going, absolutely. That's just, you just have to. And we got to the scene, and, you know, it happened that when we pulled up, it was on Rick's side of the engine. Whatever side of the engine that the fire is, that's the guy that gets the nozzle. So it was on his side, and I was quietly grateful for that. And I was his backup guy. And, you know, we unloaded the hose. We ran down the alley. We went to where the scene was.
It was a house fire.
It was an apartment fire.
Okay.
And it was on the first floor. And so anyway, we got to it. We tanked. We masked up. We got everything ready. The water came to us. And then we went on in. And we knocked down the fire, and we had it knocked down 2 or 3 times. And by the third time, everything was quieting down. We were standing in the smoke waiting for some more fire to come at us.
Explain that for those of us who don't have much understanding of what the fire
is. Well, what happens, you knock down the seat of a fire, and it may rekindle again.
And you actually specifically poke holes in the walls and the ceiling.
Well, that's later on. This is the initial attack.
Okay.
You're going in, and you're the fastest thing you want to do. What really makes the first engine really important is that you want to get in there fast, hard, and get at the seat of the fire and knock it down, boom, fast. And if you can do that, That's the reason why the fast response time. And if you can do
so
that.
So the visual here is you're on the first you're on the first floor of an apartment building, in an apartment where there's a fire, and you and your partner go in. He goes in first.
Well, we go in together.
But you're right behind
him.
I'm
right behind him.
Supporting the hose. The water comes pouring out. It knocks down the fire. The fire flames up. It knocks down again.
Sure.
And then something happens.
Well, we've got it knocked down. Smoke is in the air. We're standing there waiting. And all of a sudden, my chest tightens up and I can't breathe. And I thought, what the heck's going on? And I thought perhaps another company had come in and kind of crimped my little hose line as a prank or something like that. And of course, that didn't make sense, but I wasn't thinking properly. And it felt like there was an elephant standing on my chest. So I couldn't catch my breath. And I knew everything was all right now. The fire was out. And I hit Rick's helmet and said, "Rick, I got to go outside." He says, go ahead, Danny." So he was fine. I followed the line right back out of the apartment, and I get out there, and all of a sudden I said, "Oh my God, I'm feeling really awful." So I drop my tank, and then all of a sudden I'm on my hands and my knees, and then I'm looking on the ground, and my helmet falls off of me. As soon as that helmet hit that cement, I looked up on the second floor, and the lieutenant was up there on the second floor landing. And I looked at him, and I said, "Chest pains." That was the code, like, I'm in trouble. He went on the radio, and I mean, I collapsed. Next thing I know, six or seven pairs of hands have me lifted up in the air, throwing me on a gurney, throwing me in an ambulance, and I'm looking at my job from the reverse side. And the paramedics in the ambulance were people that I knew, and they said, "Hey, Danny, don't worry, we're taking care of you." You know, all I know is that they're throwing on a O2 on my face, a nitro patch. They're putting a heart monitor on me. You know, I was on for my big ride to the hospital from that point on. And that's what happened that night. Changed my life.
Danny Lateris is our guest. His new memoir is titled "Flames and Smoke Visible, A Firefighter's Tale." This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Danny, it might seem unusual. Well, this day that your book starts is also the day that your career, after more than 13 years as a firefighter, would end.
Right.
Why did you decide to begin your book with what many might see as an ending?
Well, you know, this is a memoir, but it's also a memoir that reads like a novel. Because predominantly, I'm a fiction writer, a novelist. And even though it was a memoir,
And in fact, when you got out of the Navy, you went into firefighting in part because the schedule would allow you
absolutely
more chunks of time to write?
Absolutely right. Okay. I mean, you know, how good is that? You think about how great this was. I got to be a firefighter and a writer at the same time. I have two of the greatest jobs on the planet Earth, as far as I'm concerned. How great is that? How life is so good. I'm doing great work on the fire ground, you know, being able to do the things you do, save people, help people, go on cutting edge danger, come home, take a shower, and then write fiction. I said, how great is that? So, and I did that for all those years. And so I have this tendency to want to write a complete work. You know, I didn't want to just write a memoir that it was a series of vignettes and, you know, disjointed sort of thing. I wanted a story that you started off with a character. There's a beginning, a middle, and an end. There's a transformation of a character, you know, the classical novel, a trajectory. And so it took a while for me to sort of find my way around the structure of this work. And it felt like starting at the end so that I can project my life as a firefighter, and that allowed me to travel throughout the entire fire ground professional world of firefighting.
Well, there are an amazing number of stories in this memoir, and we're going to get to some of those specifics, at least a few of them, before we're through with this hour. But we have to pause for a 1-minute break right now. We'll be back with novelist and memoir writer Danny Lateris in just a bit more than 60 seconds. The book is titled Flames and Smoke Visible, A Firefighter's Tale. Its author, former Norfolk City fireman Danny Lateris, is our guest. So we were talking, Danny, about why you started this memoir with what many would consider an ending. It's a day where you get rushed to the hospital after more than 13 years as a firefighter. The doctors figure out that you had a heart attack, and you're not in the hospital all that long before they tell you that your career as a fireman is over.
Right, right.
You did this in part as part of a novelist's convention. All those previous fiction books that you wrote told you that to tell a story well, starting with an ending is a really good way to go?
Well, you know, I have a long background in the arts. And, you know, I have an MFA and a BA in the theater and directing and playwriting. And I have a long tradition of learning my craft as a writer. And fiction and the theatrical world is a very big part of my life, and that's my training ground. And so so when I see a work and want to do a work, I see that in those terms. You know, people like William Shakespeare, Eugene O'Neill, Anton Chekhov, those kind of people, or the people that, you know, that influenced me, you know, Heinrich Ibsen, the playwrights, the big masters that I considered to be the big masters. So when I look at a work, when I went down hard and I was sick, and my very first year was a particularly tough year, and I knew then that I kind of wanted to write about the fire department. And now that I was gaining some distance from it, forced distance, I decided to use my stay at the hospital as the jumping off point. Because when you look at a book, you look at a work, there's always that one thing that you discover that starts you off on the work, that you use as a hook to project you into to where you want to go. And so what a natural place it was for me to start in the hospital and to think about the past and to bring the past and make it alive and to make the job accessible to civilians who don't know anything about firefighting and make it recognizable to the firefighters in the profession.
You also end up with a phenomenally interesting roommate in your hospital room. It's a two-bedroom. And I want to ask you more about that. I want to ask you more about different aspects of the book as well as your life before you became a firefighter. But for you listening, I want to ask you if you have ever wondered what the life of a firefighter is really like. Got a question for our guest. You can reach us at 888-967-2825. Or on Facebook, you can find us listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. And Danny Lateris, we have this from Sue posted to our Facebook page, and she writes, some years ago, when I was living in the Midwest, there was a terrible tragedy when a young mother pulled her car out of a side street and into the path of a racing fire truck. Police later determined that with the car windows closed, she had not been able to hear the siren. The woman and her two children were killed. Over the years, car makers have done more and more to block out any outside noise so that the inside of a vehicle is as soundproof as possible. Is this something your guests can speak to? Are we going to have many more tragedies because people simply cannot hear the outside world from inside their cars? Danny Lateris?
Well, first of all, hopefully not. That's the obvious answer. But, you know, firefighters are very much aware of the fact that people cannot hear them in their vehicles. And, you know, that sounds like a real freak accident where, you know, somebody just literally pulled out into the intersection at that last possible moment when the truck was coming through the intersection. And believe me, when the driver comes pulling into an intersection, they're looking. Everybody's looking, the captain, the driver. And they actually start breaking down a lot of times when they come to these intersections. wary that somebody may or may not have heard them or disregarded the sirens and still try to beat them to the intersection. So it's a real common problem.
But does Sue have a reasonable point that these days cars are designed so that we're not really going to hear
the car and the culture? I mean, people are involved in listening to the radio, talking on the cell phone, smoking their cigarettes, talking to their kids in the back seat. And the cars are designed to be quieter, running the air conditioner or the heater or whatever. There are so many things competing with the outside world that I don't know, you know, where that's going, except that it just makes it a little harder for the fire department to drive out there. And believe me, fire departments, they're all about safety first and last. All these kinds of variables are considered in getting out to a scene. You know, you get out to the scene as fast as you can, but you don't be crazy about getting there. If you can see that they can't hear you and you pull back and you wait, if it adds 15, 20 seconds to the runtime, so be it, rather than hurting somebody getting out there. So, yep, it's a real problem, but fire department people, police and paramedics are constantly adjusting for those kinds of things that are going on in our culture.
Danny Letaris, what is it about the life of a firefighter that you suspect most people don't understand or have no idea about that you think it might be nice if they did?
Wow, that's a very, very good question. I mean, first and foremost, firefighters, police, and rescue, they're trying to do the good thing. They're out there to help people and to save them. They want to do the right things. And oftentimes what happens is that people often think that the biggest problem is people oftentimes think we don't get there fast enough. And what happens is the 3-minute runtime seems like 30 minutes to people. Can't tell you how often we've gotten to a scene, literally between 2 and 3 minutes, and they said, "What took you so long? We've been here 15, 20 minutes." Complete impossibility, but that's their perception. And so people really don't know that. And oftentimes people don't think about the public safety people until they need them. And we know that. And in a sense, that's because we do the job so well, we don't want them to think that we're out there. It's like we do such a good job that they take us for granted. And in a sense, that's really a kind of a neat thing, that they're worry-free until they need us, and they don't regard us until they need us. And that's because we do a good job.
It was mentioned a little earlier that one of the reasons you were excited after you left the Navy when you found out about the possibility of taking a job as a firefighter was because the schedule would allow you more solid chunks of time to do something that you would love to do for many years in your life, and that was right.
Right.
Tell us what that schedule was.
Well, the schedule was called the 21-day cycle. And in that 21-day cycle that rotates literally every 21 days, no matter where it falls on the calendar. And in that period of time, you'll have a 2-day period off and then a 3-day period off, and separated by one 24-hour period from another 2-day period off. In other words,
Okay, but when you were working, how many hours would you often be on at a time?
You're on always 24 hours. Okay, so, you know, the longest stretch is the long stretch in the 21-day cycle, when it's 24 hours on, 24 hours off, 24 on, off, on, off, on, off, on, and then you got 2 days off.
And one of the other things that becomes clear in reading your book, Flames and Smoke Visible, Danny, is that you are often not doing the same thing. And one of the things that apparently most firefighters don't love is when they get shifted to another firehouse, another completely different set of duties than what they usually do. And you have an example of that, the day that you got assigned to a ladder truck?
Can
you read from what, I think it starts on page 83?
Yes.
From your book?
Okay.
Just give us a sample of that, if you will.
All right. Now, I'm filling in on this station. And, you know, filling in is sort of an adjustment of manpower because, you know, people are off or on sick leave or any number of reasons, and you have to have people in those spots. The job is a relieve on station type of job. When you go to work, you actually say, okay, you can go home, you know, and you don't leave your job until a guy comes in to actually let you go. So if you don't get a relief in the morning, you stay on the job until somebody's hired on to let you go.
But riding a high ladder into a fire,
here we go,
is not something you would normally do in your assignment.
Most of my career was in an engine company, and in this particular time, I was assigned to a ladder company in another station. So this is what this ladder company is all about. Ready?
And we hear, in your words, from Flames and Smoke Visible, Danny Lateris.
Right. This is from Chapter 21, Ladder Truck. I was filling in Station 10, which was a three-piece station, an engine, a ladder truck, the 3rd District Battalion Chief's car. I was assigned to the ladder truck for 24 hours. The brass hit. Then the watchroom's monitor radio toned out all over the station via a network of speakers. 10-1 house fire, 2901 Tarrant Street, engine 10, ladder 10, battalion 3, respond to a 10-1 house fire at 2901 Tarrant Street, flames and smoke visible, timeout 1533. Men filtered into the apparatus floor from all directions, through the watchroom and the galley doors, from the barracks bedroom doors, and by the hallway door leading to the admin offices and the officer's bedroom. One man came from the outside phone's cubbyhole. Another man came from the workshop at the rear of the station. What had been a static space filled with parked vehicles had become a beehive filled with activity. Men dashed to their stations, stepped into their boots, struggled into their turnout coats, and climbed on board the engine or the ladder or the chief's car without uttering a word. This momentary silence was interrupted by the start of diesel engines. Running lights flooded the apparatus floor. Wind and rain swirled through the opened overhead door. Radio chatter filled the air. SCBA tanks' bells rang as men opened their cylinder valve. And 3 diesel engines roared as they crept smartly onto the apron into the heavy weather. The ladder was on the left side of the station, and the engine was on the right side of the station with the chief's car behind it. Lightning and thunder accompanied the sudden blare of sirens, and the increased roar of diesel engines accelerating onto Virginia Beach Boulevard, where the engine, followed by the chief's car, followed by the ladder truck, took an immediate right onto the Azalea Garden Road, raced toward Princess Anne Road at a powerful speed. The streets were flooded. There was little traffic. As soon as I slipped on my gloves and tightened my helmet's chin strap, I settled into my wet, open jump seat and contemplated Earth's ancient elements that I was about to be fully immersed in. Water, wind, fire. I loved it. God help me, I loved it. Ladder 10 maneuvered around Engine 10, which had to stop to hook up to the hydrant. Then Ladder 10 drove past Engine 14, which was already on the scene and in command, and stopped near a 3-story structure in front of 14. Lenny, the driver-operator, engaged a 100-foot aerial ladder's hydraulic pump after setting the brakes and jumped out of the cab to chalk the wheels. The Lieutenant Gillis and Gillis, the other tailboard firefighter, went to the left side of the ladder to pull out and set the side-screw jack stabilizers and ground plates, while me and Beasley, the tillerman, set the other pair of jacks on the right side in order to stabilize the truck. Lenny went to the rear of the ladder after he chocked the wheels and climbed onto the aerial's turntable, where he positioned himself behind the operator's control pedestal. As soon as the jacks were in place, Lenny elevated the aerial ladder to the desired angle, slowly rotated the ladder assembly until the tip of the ladder was pointing toward the roof of the house, extended the fly section beyond the roof, then lowered the ladder until the beams rested against the side of the house and several rungs projected past the top of the roof. With the ladder in position, Lenny locked the hydraulic valve, then set the ladder and turntable locks. We armed ourselves with two pickhead axes, a pike pole, a roof ladder, a Halligan tool, and a gasoline-powered K-12 saw that used a circular blade to cut through the shingles, tar paper, and wood. The wind and the rain increased, and a blinding flash of lightning accompanied by a deafening clap of thunder momentarily paralyzed us.
I hate to interrupt.
Go right ahead.
But in radio, we realize that every 3 or 4 minutes, a whole bunch of new people have joined in. And so to them, I want to say that you've been hearing author Danny Lateris read a section from his new memoir, Flames and Smoke Visible. For a bit more than 13 years, Danny worked as a firefighter in Norfolk, Virginia. We got a really great sample of the beautiful wordsmithing that you do in this book, Danny.
Oh, thank you.
But let's jump ahead and just tell us the bottom line of that story, of your experience working with a company that you didn't usually work with, riding a ladder up into a fire in a storm, in a lightning thunderstorm.
I know.
What's the bottom line from that story, would you say?
Well, I'll read you the very last line of the segment I was going to say. Read to you. A crack of lightning split the sky and threatened to kill the world. It's that dangerous sometimes. It is so dangerous and so perilous that you just can't think about it. You climb that aerial ladder to the roof with all these tools and you're cutting holes in a roof while lightning is bouncing all around you. And it's insanity. I mean, it's the worst possible conditions. It's every kind of condition you're told not to be in, and that's where you are. And you have to be there. There is no choice. You must. It's a calling. That's what this job is about. It's a calling.
Danny Lateris, you've been quoted as saying that this book, in part, is about what it means to be and what it means to not be. Explain that to me.
Well, I tell you what, it's easier to read a little tiny segment of that very thing.
Well, we've got about a minute before we're going to hit the break.
Okay.
Can you just put it in your own words for now, what it means to be and what it means to not be?
Well, you know, oftentimes we ask ourselves what it means to be, what it means to no longer be what you are. Sometimes what it means to no longer be what you are, you have to face yourself. So
part of that has to do with the fact that in this memoir, you're not only talking about your and other people's experiences as firefighters, but also you coming to terms with the fact that that part of your life is now ending.
Right. What it means to be, as well as what it means to no longer be to be able to be what one has been. That is a key thing. Aren't we always that for ourselves, everybody on this planet? Absolutely.
We could probably devote an hour to that.
Easily.
But
easily.
Maybe we'll have a little bit more time for it.
I hope so.
As well as other aspects of your life as described in this new memoir, Flames and Smoke Visible by Danny Lateris. I also want to ask you about some stuff that's not in the book. We'll get to that too when we get back from the break in a bit more than 1 minute. Danny Lateris is our guest. His new memoir is titled Flames and Smoke Visible, A Firefighter's Tale. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Now, Danny, long before your career as a firefighter, you spent a year in the late 60s in Vietnam saving lives as a kind of medic, a Navy corpsman?
Corpsman. I was a corpsman.
How'd that come about?
Back in 67, when the war is raging, we're all going to the war. We're all going to be drafted. And I was going to go in. And as soon as I graduated from high school, I was 17 when I graduated from high school, turned 18 in July, weeks after I graduated. And I went straight to the recruiter, joined the Navy. At the time, I thought I wanted to be, I was considering becoming a doctor. Going to medical school, after the military. Military was what I wanted to do the military. I wanted to experience that. And I also wanted to earn the GI Bill so I can go to college. So I go to a recruiter. I wanted to be a, and the last year and a half of my high school, I was an orderly at Baptist Hospital in Miami. So I decided I wanted to be a corpsman in the Navy. However, I did not know that corpsmen in the Navy were transferred into the Marine Corps and went to Vietnam as part of the Marine forces.
Not everybody knows that a Navy corpsman is, in essence, what most of us think of as a battlefield medic.
Right, right. And I, you know what? I didn't at the time either. So I was, I should have known that. I was a little suspicious when the chief at the recruiting office just gave me a big hug like I had done the greatest thing in the world. And I thought, hey, you know, all I want to be is a corpsman. He said, you'll get it in writing. Anyway, no regrets. I ended up going to corps school. And literally, you know, I was in the Navy a very short period of time when I got transferred into the Marine Corps. The great time. I love the Marine Corps. I love the men in the Marine Corps.
Do I understand, though, that once you got to Vietnam and saw where you were going to be and what you were going to be doing, that you did not expect to survive?
Absolutely not. And when I got there, I had been with a artillery units with the Marine Corps for quite some time, and I thought that's what I was going to be doing when I got to Vietnam. When the plane pulled into Da Nang, we got off the plane, they gathered us all together and says, everybody here is going to the Marine Corps grunts, all corpsmen. Well, to me, that was a death sentence because I had heard that the life expectancy for corpsmen was very low, you know, 2 weeks, a few weeks at was all you had. And I was, you know, I lit a cigarette at the time I smoked, and I thought, oh, man, I'm done for. I really believe this. Just at that point, a Jeep pulled up. And there was a chief hospital corpsman in the Marine Corps utilities, and they stopped the Jeep. He stood up on the tail board of the tail of the Jeep and said, I need 6 volunteers to the recons. And I said, what? What's that? And so I raised my hand. I said, Chief, is that like the recon rangers, John Wayne and all that? He said, yep. Threw my sea bag in there. I says, I'm in. Because I figured, well, you know, if I'm going to go, I'm also go with the professionals, go with the best. That was my logic.
So, you started in country in Vietnam in July of 1969.
Right.
You exited Vietnam in July of 1970.
1970, right.
Startlingly surprised, as I understand how right. you've put it, that you were still alive.
Absolutely.
What were you determined to do once you realized you were getting on that plane still alive and leaving Vietnam?
Oh, that's an easy question for me. That's one that's very important. To live my life as to live a good life, as good a life as I can, in honor of those who could not come back. If I was one of those that made it out of there, I owed it to the guys that I knew who were killed there to live as good a life as I could live. Doggone it, I did that. Because when I first got there, my very first patrol was a terrible patrol, a lot of combat, and I thought, oh my gosh, I got a whole year of this, I'm not going to make it. I swear, I didn't think I was going to make it. And I managed to do 20 patrols in my first 6 months with the regular recons, and then I was transferred to the dive locker where I did 80 combat dives in the last 6 months as a hospital corpsman. And then I made it out of there. And I was literally on that Freedom Bird, that plane, thinking, okay, I made it, and I'm going to live as well as I can. I'm going to go to college, and I'm going to have a good life in honor of those who were not able to come back.
The book is titled "Flames and Smoke Visible: A Firefighter's Tale." Its author, former Norfolk City fireman Danny Lateris, is our guest. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Next to Stanton. Kelly, thanks for calling in. Your question or comment for Danny, please.
Hi. I really enjoy the show. I'm really enjoying the speaker today. Thanks for having me on. I think typically we see firefighters and think of them in situations with fire. But 5 years ago, when I was 21 years old, I got in a really bad car accident on a Sunday morning in North Carolina on Interstate 95. And the firefighters were the first ones on the scene. I was conscious and my left arm was very badly damaged. It was a very gruesome scene, but the firefighter that kneeled down to me and spoke with me until the ambulances could get there on the side of the road, I really do believe helped save my life because he helped keep me calm and helped me from bleeding too much. And I just want to thank all firefighters for all the situations that they are put in and fight for us. But I just want to thank that specific firefighter, never got his name, but that day really just helped keep me calm, and it was great. So,
thank you for all firefighters. You know, that's the heart of it right there. You've thank you for that. You thanked all the fire service people out there. We don't forget that part of the job, in the whole saving of life thing, there is always one of us that comes up to that poor victim out there mm-hmm. and try to calm you and talk to you and reach you in some emotional level. Mm-hmm. And I'm really glad that you got that experience in the sense that I'm sorry you had the accident, needless to say,
but
makes me proud of being a firefighter. It makes me proud of being part of the police, fire, and rescue, public safety, because those are my people. I love these people, but this is what we do. And, I don't know what more to say to that, except that that's not an uncommon event. That is a norm among firefighters. This is what we do in the home, on the streets, in a burning building, anywhere. This is what we do. So I'm really glad you got that. I really am.
Kelly, thank you so very much for your call.
Thanks.
Danny Lateris, after Vietnam, you tried your hand in theater as an actor and as a director, even directing in New York for a while. Why those careers?
Well, I love the theater, and when I was a boy, I had gone to some theater with my mother to shows in New York and all of that, and I loved it. And I said, man, this is me. And I, years later, when we moved to Miami, I was the youngest member of the Southern Shakespeare Repertory Company when I was 12 and 13. And, I got to know Shakespeare on an intimate level. I used to go to the rehearsals, whether I was in the rehearsals or not, because I wanted to hear it, see it. And so the theater was a really great thing for me. And that's why, like I said, playwrights are my people. That's where I learned how to write. And it's been my training ground as an artist and as a novelist. And I've loved the performing arts. But, I found that it was a difficult life.
Making a living at it
exactly.
was not easy.
It was not easy.
Is that why you went back into the Navy in the early 80s?
At the time, actually it was. That was a financial consideration. Actually, it really was. I always felt like the Navy would be an alternative for me. And it presented itself to me. And I said, let me give the Navy a try as an officer. And golly gosh, I took the test and they said, what do you want? I said, I was a diver. He said, you want to be a deep sea diving and salvage officer? And I said, yeah. And I was one of the lucky ones that actually got all the training and ended up on a diving and salvage ship.
Man with an MFA now who's been directing theater in New York joins the Navy and starts diving off of ships to do salvage work. Okay. Flames and Smoke Visible, A Firefighter's Tale is the name of Danny Lateris' newest book. It is his first work of nonfiction. And Danny, all of your previous published works have been either poetry or novels.
Right.
And if I understand correctly, some of those titles include Judas the Gentile, The Silence of John, Jerusalem's Reign, In the Heart of Things. Do I sense a theme here?
Yeah, there is a spiritual theme that runs throughout all my work, including Flames and Smoke Visible. This idea of not knowing oneself, losing oneself. That's a spiritual component of ourselves. But I have a series of five books that are quote unquote biblical historicals that puts flesh and blood on the people of that time and, makes them the flawed human beings that we all are, trying to reach out to their spiritual selves and in the event of that time. And that's the Christianity of part of it. That's the Day of the Crucifixion. The In the Heart of Things series, which deals with Zen and Buddhism in America. And I did that first. I did In the Heart of Things, Into the Ashes, and Half Hidden by Twilight, which is a trilogy, all standalone books, I might add. that deal with Zen and Buddhism in America. And after I've completed that that series, I said, you know, let's just, what other spirituality I need to check out? And, you know, Christianity being a dominant force in America, I said, let me check this out. So I started looking into some of the areas that aren't written about. Judas, the Thieves of Golgotha deals with the two thieves who died with Jesus. Very little is written about that. Judas the Gentile deals with the denial. Jerusalem's Reign deals with Peter, and Peter denied him. Judas betrayed him. And then the Silence of John is about the women who surrounded Jesus and took care of Jesus before, during, and after. And then you have the final book, The Master of Secrets, that deals with a boy and the perspective of what the boy felt and saw during that time. You have to understand this is all pre-Christianity. This is a sect of Judaism. Christianity doesn't exist per se. It's part of the Jewish world. So I write from that perspective. And these are flawed people trying to do the right thing. You know, the common theme in all my work is these people are always trying to find the right path, so to speak. Even my counterculture returning war veteran book, which is my 613 West Jefferson, which takes place in Tallahassee, Florida, is my counterculture book dealing with sex, drugs, rock and roll, seen through the eyes of a Vietnam War veteran who is kind of confused, not knowing where he's going to go, where to turn to. He's war torn, and he's trying to find that positive path to a productive life. But he doesn't even know that at the beginning of the book. Still, he's just gotten out, and now he's in a college town trying to figure things out. So all my books have this theme of spirituality, metaphysics, religion, whatever you want to call it. It's the theme that runs through everything I do as a writer, because I believe those are the important things in the world. You
know, Danny Letaris, we've only got a couple of minutes left. You've established both in terms of what's in this new book, Flames and Smoke Visible, your new memoir, as well as what you've told us about your experience of being a firefighter, that you saw it as a spiritual experience.
Mm-hmm.
Was that just you? Were you different than most other firefighters that way? Or would you make an argument that most firefighters see spirituality as an important part of their lives and their work?
Yes, I do. You know, most firefighters, you know, they're family people, they're spiritual people in whatever endeavor they are, whether it's Christian, non-Christian, whatever it is that they believe in. A lot of them are ex-military. And you think about the kind of work that it is. You know, you're trying to save a person, help a person in a medical situation or in a dangerous situation. And there would be times when, you know, like our caller in, here is a guy, he didn't have to do that extra step of going to her and talking to her and calming her and giving her reassurance.
Kelly with her car accident.
Kelly with her car accident. I mean, that's a perfect example. And that's the norm. That's why I love these people, because they're really trying to do the right thing. And, you know, I'm no exception, and I'm just part of that, the same kind of breed of person. You know, you get out there and, you know, you gotta work hard at not becoming jaded. You know, a lot of times, you know, you see a lot of bad things out there, and it's easy to start looking askance and start being resentful, and you can't do it because that's not your job. Your job is to be, like, non-judgmental and just do the job and help them. You don't know what their lives are about, and it's not your job to judge that. It's just hopefully giving them a second chance, and if they see a little compassion at that moment when they need it the most, maybe that's the one thing that might turn them around. It's really, you know, just a soft thing that we all do, I think. And firefighters, they look like this big, gruff bunch of guys, and they are. But they're also a bunch of soft guys, too, and gals. You know, I like the idea that the women in the fire department now, I remember when that was happening, and they've brought a very good component into the fire department that I think is very valuable, and I'm really proud that they were finally brought into the fire department after so many years.
May I tell you that I am truly sad that we are out of time.
Same here.
Our guest has been Danny Lateris, author of the new memoir, Flames and Smoke Visible, A Firefighter's Tale. Danny, thank you so very much for making time for us.
Thank you very much, Tom. I really appreciate it. Appreciate you, and really glad to be here.
Virginia Insight's executive producer, Matt Bingay. Associate producers, Terry Ward and Bob Levicky. Some of our break music supplied by Robert Jospe and Inner Rhythm. Thanks for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more insight.